This podcast has been generously sponsored by Evan Walkenstein on the occasion of his marriage to Gabby Moskowitz, who teaches him everything he knows about life, and with thanks to Judy Klitzner, who taught him everything he knows about Torah. For more information about sponsoring a Pardes podcast, email jamie@pardes.org. This Pardes Life is an original podcast production from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, please visit www.elmad.pardes.org, elmad.pardes.org.
Shalom, this is C. Hirschfield, and you are currently listening to This Pardes Life, Season 2. And in this exciting new season of This Pardes Life, we are going to be mixing into these wonderful interviews with Pardes faculty a little learning, a little chavruta learning that I am privileged to do with Pardes colleagues. This is actually just an excuse for me to force them to sit and learn with me and hear their words of Torah. So today I am privileged to be joined by my friend, colleague, and teacher, Judy Klitzner, who has been teaching at Pardes for quite some time. And is a published author and noted speaker, and got a great sense of humor on top of that. So I will give her no more introduction, but just say welcome, Judy.
Hi. Thank you, Tzvi. I feel very welcome. And now let's launch into it. I would like to talk about chapter 21 in the book of Bereishit, which, as we all know, is the Torah reading for the first day of Rosh Hashanah. And lots of people want to understand why, of all things to read, do we read this story, which is a strange story of sibling rivalry, of struggles between Abraham's two wives. Why is this something that we emphasize? My take on this is that this chapter is going to be a transitional chapter for us and is going to lay the groundwork so that when the Akedah story is read on day two of Rosh Hashanah, we're going to be ready for it. And it is something that is very, very difficult to be ready for. It's something that is, in my opinion, one of the hardest things to understand. Unfortunately, the academic year is based in which Pardes takes part, begins in September with Rosh Hashanah, and we're supposed to teach the Akedah then, which confuses and perplexes everyone. So, in an effort to try to understand this, I want to start with a little bit of background. But Tzvi, since this is supposed to be a conversation, is there anything you would like to interject at this moment?
Well, I just want to say, I mean, I was always taught it's either because God remembers Sarah, and that's what God does in Rosh Hashanah, or it's quite literally just like the pretext, so to speak, before the big crescendo of the Akedah. And if I understand you correctly, we need to learn something here first in order to fully appreciate what we're going to read on day two. So for everyone who is going to skip Torah reading on day one because it's not the main event, you're telling us actually no, this is part of the main event.
Yes. And in fact, I would say that this is something, if I wanted to state this in a very coarse way, which of course I wouldn't want to, so just ignore what I'm about to say, which is that this starts off as a bit of an emotional soap opera, and it ends up with Avraham acting in an Akedah mode, a kind of robotic suspension of his own ethical principles, of his own thoughts, and doing the very difficult thing that God expects of him. How does Avraham get from this emotional mess to becoming Avraham who's ready for an Akedah? Okay, that's where I'm going with this. So, as background to this story, before we dive into the story itself, I just want to get, where are Avraham and Sarah in this story altogether? And I think it's important to note that Sarah, when we first meet her, is infertile. And we know that that's a problem because all of the promises are based on progeny, right? In order for the promises to Avraham to come to fruition, there have to be children, and there are no children. She is silent for several chapters. God speaks to Avraham. There's this long conversation going on between them, but it's all exclusive to the two of them. Sarah is not even mentioned. In chapter 15, she finally steps in, 16 rather, she finally steps into the picture and she tries surrogacy, which kind of fails. And at a certain point, God steps up and says to Avraham, listen, I'm talking about not just you, I'm talking about you and her. Sarah is going to be this mother in this covenantal equation. What happens when Avraham finds out that Sarah is supposed to be the actual mother and that they're going to have this miraculous birth, the two of them at the ages of 90 and 100. Avraham's response is?
Laughter, everyone.
Okay, well done, Zvi. Yes,
it's... That's the response I get to most of my
questions. Okay. He falls on his face laughing, and he says this amazing thing. He says, Lu Yishmael yichye lefanecha. If only Yishmael would live before you. Now, this is really odd. Here God is saying, I'm going to give you a new child, a brand new shiny child, with your actual wife. And Avraham laughs and says, I'm good. I've got somebody already. You don't have to make me such outlandish promises. This is the backdrop, I think, to chapter 21, where we're going to meet these characters after these two children now are both in play. There is an inevitable conflict that's coming, and that's the emotional difficulty that I was talking about earlier. So let's get into this. Verse 1. Why don't you read?
Okay. I'm glad I was chosen. There's quite a competition in here. Sorry, Louise, but it's going to be me today. Vashem pakad et Sarah kasher amar, vayas Hashem l'Sarah kasher diber. V'tahar v'teled Sarah l'Avraham ben l'zekunav, l'moed asher diber oto Elohim.
Let's translate that first verse and notice how very problematic it is. Vashem pakad et Sarah kasher amar. God, how would you translate that?
Well, I guess if either pakad, I instinctively translate as remembered or took careful note of, maybe even appointed, I guess you could go with. I don't know.
Okay. Sounds good. Yes. As God, kasher amar, as God had said, vayas Hashem l'sara kasher diber. God, go ahead. Whoops.
Well, it seems kind of a repetition. Yes. God did, which then you're wondering, how is Yas and Pakad doing, and whatever Pakad means different? And what does Kasher Diber add to Kasher Amar? Both seem to be saying, as he said.
Fantastic. Okay, so this is a great way to address any biblical verse, is to take a good long look at it and ask, what's problematic here? And you pointed out problem number one is it seems to be redundant. Both pieces seem to be saying the same thing. Any ideas on why that would be? Why repeat it?
I guess sometimes you would want to repeat for emphasis, mm-hmm. right? To show that, wow, they've really been waiting for this for a long time and mm-hmm. it's finally here and I'm noting that it's finally here. Or mm-hmm. that maybe there were multiple things promised. Great. And maybe there's a reference to two separate promises.
I like what you said about the repetition for emphasis. And in fact, if we look at Sarah's fertility life, the experiences of her fertility, we note that the first statement about her fertility is actually about her infertility. And that also is stated in double language, right? Vatihi Sarai akara ein la valad. The same question comes up there. Why state it twice? And I think there it's emphatic because it's so unexpected that she's going to be infertile. Up until that point, all the women had children. Here, what's expected is that she's going to remain infertile because she's very, very old. But the text is announcing in this very ceremonious style, wow, she's going to have this child. The problem, though, is I think a bigger problem than the repetition is, what is this kasher amar and kasher diber? That makes us wonder, well, to whom did God speak about Sarah's impending birth? God actually spoke to Sarah only once, only three words directly, and they were words of rebuke. God said to Sarah, Lo ki tzachakt. No, but you laughed. It's more words in English. What is this referring to? When did God speak to her? So what do we do with that?
So I guess my association, and I know I'm probably not going to get it right, but that scene when the angels come to visit and Avram's informed, and that famous one where she's by the tent, I always thought there was an ambiguity whether they're talking to him, but are they aware that they're also addressing her? Is she an eavesdropper, or is she sort of secondarily included? But it also, at least in this context, it doesn't say as God spoke to her. So it could be just referencing the promises. I guess the problem with that is it's pakad et Sarah. So on the one hand, she is the subject of this sentence. But as you're saying, when it comes to God's promising, Avram is the subject of those sentences. So there's a dissonance, and I can't solve it. And that's why I teach Talmud and not Chumash.
Well, for a Talmud teacher, you didn't do too badly just there. I would like to pick up on your on your drawing in chapter 18, where God sends three visitors to tell Abraham about this impending birth, about the miracle. And as we remember, Sarah is deep inside the tent while Abraham is engaging these visitors in near the entrance to the tent. And they say these three very evocative words to him. They say to him, Ayeh Sarah Ishtecha. And the word Ayeh is a great word because it doesn't actually mean where is the location of something. We have a different word for that. What would that be?
Apho.
Right, you're asking for the location of something.
So stressful.
All right, give this man a drink.
So stressful.
Okay. Apho, yeah. Right? And in fact, if you're walking around here in this holy city of Jerusalem and you're looking for the closest grocery store, here's a tip. Don't go up to a stranger and say, Ayeh hamakolet. This will not be taken well by that Israeli. When we want the location of something, we ask Apho. But Ayeh means something else. It has a much more specific meaning. I learned from my teacher, Nechama Leibovitz, Zichrona Livracha, that Ayeh is usually making a point. It's usually rhetorical, like Ayeka in the Garden of Eden. It doesn't mean tell me where you are, Adam. And that's why when he says, I'm over here hiding behind this bush, that is kind of what we call in the trade chutzpah, that the question wasn't intended to be taken literally. And I think these three messengers of God, when they say Ayeh Sarah Ishtecha, are also not asking for her physical whereabouts. They're asking, why isn't she here? Right? Why does she have to eavesdrop on the inside of the tent when we're here to tell her something that is so essential to her own future? And I think that is part of this. God remembers her as God has spoken. In some sense, God has already been speaking of Sarah, has been giving messages to Abraham that it's time to include her. Don't fall on your face laughing and don't say, if only Yishmael would live before you. Yes, you have another son, and yes, God is going to say, I understand you have feelings for that son and for that son's mother, but covenantally speaking, there's something else that I'm expecting of you here, and that includes, in the covenantal equation, it includes Sarah and it includes Yitzchak. And I think what's going to happen in this story is a kind of imposed transition on the part of Abraham from a more emotional, ethical way of responding to things to a more covenantal way of responding to things. Right, Svi, let's keep in mind, in Sodom, when God says, I'm going to wipe out this entire city of sinners, what does Abraham do?
He defends, he advocates, he jumps in.
Doesn't accept God's word at face value. He is the tiger. He fights God at every level and wins. What happens to that Abraham? Here in this story, I would argue at the beginning of this story, we find that Abraham, where he's still in this on an emotional, ethical level. He's got a child. The child's name is Yishmael. But now there's a new child. What do I do with this? Right? He can't fall on his face laughing anymore. He's got to contend with this. And he's got different mothers with different hopes and different ambitions for their children. What's he going to do? All right, before we get to that, let's go back to the text and note there's a very interesting emphasis here. Please continue reading.
Okay, verse 2. Vatahar v'telet sarah l'Avraham ben l'skunav l'moed asher diber oto Elohim.
One more, please.
Vayikra Avraham et shem beno hanolad lo asher yalda lo Sarah Yitzchak. Okay, so she became pregnant and gave birth to Avram, a son for his old age, at the appointed time from which God spoke to him. And Avram called the name of his son that was born to him that was born to him through Sarah. Yitzchak. I like all those born to hims, right. Born to hims,
great.
And then emphasizing Sarah afterwards.
Great. Okay. Notice in these verses the extreme emphasis, the possessive pronouns here. Almost every time, ben lizkunav, in his old age, in the time that God had spoken to him, Abraham calls the name of his son,
who was born to him,
whom Sarah bore to him, Yitzchak. And the next verse, Vayamol Avraham et Yitzchak bino. Oh, we didn't know it was his son. Why does the text have to keep on saying that? His son, his son, his son, his son. This extreme emphasis on the relationship between Avraham and Yitzchak, I think, is in a sense almost protesting too much. We get a sense of Avraham's connection, building connection with this son, his effort to make a connection with his son Yitzchak. Perhaps he feels it, this elation at the birth of the child. He is he's bonding with his son. The son is mentioned consistently in relation to him. Verse 5 continues it. V'Avraham ben Me'at Shana Behivaled Lo et Yitzchak Beno, born to him, Yitzchak, his son. Suddenly, though, something begins to change. And this is the part where I think the transition happens. Sarah is already starting to sense that something's up. And let's look now in verse 6, please.
Okay, V'Tomer Sarah, Tzchok Asali Elohim, Kol HaShomea Yitzchak Li. Well, I guess it depends what you want to do with tzchok. We could translate, and Sarah said, laughter, God made laughter for me, which I guess, I don't know, and I could take it either as God made a joke out of me, that's the negative reading, or God has filled my mouth with happy laughter, right? And anyone who listens will laugh, and again, I feel there's an ambiguity, either laugh at me or laugh with me. Share my joy that I'm a woman this old who finally had a child, or mock me because I look like I am nursing and raising my own great-grandchild.
Okay, so I think you really zoomed in on, I think, the artistic ambiguity here. And I think perhaps she's getting it both. There's a bit of mockery here. There's certainly happiness, elation. She's been redeemed. This is what she's been yearning for throughout her story. But at the same time, she senses, I think there's a sense of foreboding, and I think Sarah is the first one to pick up on it. Notice the key words here, tzchok and shomea, which are kind of the code words for the two sons. Yitzchak is the tzchok son, the laughter son, and Yishmael is the hearing son. And she's saying, kol ha-shomea Yitzchak li. There's going to be this inevitable clash between the shomea son and the Yitzchak son. She's seeing it coming. And then I think in verse 8, if we can skip for a moment to verse 8, the child grows up. And I think as long as Yitzchak is a baby, the real problem doesn't emerge. Avraham is still in his bonding stage with this child. He's trying it on. I think he's feeling the happiness. But when the child becomes weaned, suddenly I think the feeling of inevitable clash becomes much more apparent. And here they make this great party. This is in verse 8, Vayas Avraham Mishteh Gadol Biyom Higamel Et Yitzchak. He makes a party on the day that Isaac is weaned. And notice for the first time in this chapter, Yitzchak is mentioned without what's missing here?
Without Beno.
Hey, I got that right.
Well done.
A little bit of
See,
put down that sign that says Beno.
Well, I don't know if this microphone picks up whispering, so I'm going to assume it doesn't. Yitzchak. For the first time, we have Yitzchak without the qualifier, without connecting him back to Avraham. And I think perhaps what we're getting here is Avraham's perspective. This is now, the confusion is starting to set in. Up until now, he has been convinced that this is my son, my son, my son, my son, this is the one. But wait a minute, when the child is old enough to create some kind of potential conflict with the son that he already loves, maybe it isn't his son.
Well, also, it's interesting because you'd think, my sense is when the child is weaned is precisely when this young man is now supposed to be with his father all day, right? In other words, when the son doesn't need to be with mom, the natural progression is, okay, now it's time to follow dad around and learn how to manage the farm, who knows what they're managing. But in the sense that he has this big party for him, I think it's supposed to be this transitional party. Now you're going to take your place by my side. And the fact that it's not mentioned is Beno, because now he realizes if he's going to take his place by his side, someone else is going to be pushed farther along. But it's interesting that they don't there's no communication between Avram is not laying down the law to his family saying, listen, now that Yitzchak is here, things are going to change. And he and Sarah aren't communicating about it either.
Well, sadly, I would say that the communication between Avraham and Sarah has never been, an outstanding point. Certainly not as presented by the text. We don't get a lot of processing that goes on between them, and that certainly is absent here. What we have instead is that Sarah observes, right in verse 9, "Vatera Sarah et ben Hagar haMitzrit." To her, everything is very clear. Yishmael is that son of a maid, Asher Yalda LaAvraham, and he's doing this very shady thing, ambiguous thing, mitzachek. As you said earlier, that is an ambiguous term. Is it mocking? Is it laughing? Is it happiness? We're going to leave that because that's for another conversation. But whatever it is, Sarah seems to find it supremely threatening. And it's a deal breaker. She says, that's it. To Avraham, she says, get rid of them both. And I wanted to skip ahead now to verse 11. If we're following the use of the word Beno, his son, surprisingly, what happens here is a complete flip. Vayera hadavar me'od be'enei Avraham al odot Beno. Sarah says to him, get rid of Yishmael and Hagar. And now the thing is very bad in the eyes of Avraham al odot Beno, regarding his son. Which son is he talking about? Which son?
It would seem like Yishmael.
Yishmael. And now if there is a Beno in this story, it's no longer Yitzhak. The transition seems to be complete, where he has followed his feelings. Instead of thinking covenantally, right? God has been promising me the fact that this is the real son. This is not the real son. They're both real sons, but the son that's going to carry on my spiritual legacy. And now he's decided that if he has to choose one, it seems, he's going to choose Yishmael.
Well, especially the verse previously, she actually mentions, get rid of them, he's not going to inherit. So it sounds like Avram has not pushed Yishmael outside and made Yitzchak his main guy. And she calls Yitzchak Bini, her son, as opposed to saying your son, which means she's on to the fact of that Yitzchak, even after the big party, the transition has not happened, and it doesn't look like, and I'm shocked because I'm seeing this for the first time this way, he has not put Yitzchak as number one son. And she's on to that, and she's emphasizing wrong. He's got Yishmael has the wrong lineage. He's not the promised son. We all know that. God said it to you and to me. You're not following through with the plan that God laid out that we're supposed to be doing here.
So we've got Sarah who's tuned into the godly plan, which happens to coincide with her own personal hopes. And she gives the order, which God then upholds, get rid of them. And it's very cruel, certainly to a sensitive reader. How can she say, throw them out? And it gets worse. We're not going to have time to look into the text, you know, the whole account of it, but it sounds as though, Avraham is being asked to throw them out to what is a possible life-threatening situation. Go out into the desert, and what we're going to find out there is that they don't even have enough water to live. They're going to be Yishmael is going to be in immediate danger of death. I want to argue that what happens now, the transition now begins right here.
This is Akedah 1.
It's Akedah 1 precisely. It's the theme and it's the language. And here, but the crucial piece here is the transition, and that is verse 12. Where God steps in and says, Avraham, you've been responding like a normal father. You're upset about this. You love this child. And God even intimates you love this woman, this mother of this child. I acknowledge that. But God is saying, that's not what I'm calling for here. You are no longer expected to respond to me in the way that you did back in Sodom, where you follow your conscience and you follow your feelings. Now I want something else from you. I want you to be quiet and I want you to do what the covenant expects of you. And that is send this child away. Accomplish exactly what you said, Akedah number one. And notice the language all of a sudden. In verse 14, Vayashkem Avraham Baboker. That's straight out Akedah language. He wakes up early in the morning, and we've got this string of action verbs, just as we have in the Akedah. We're going to have a life-threatening situation for the child. We're going to have a last minute reprieve that's going to miraculously spare the life of the child. We're going to have an angel calling down from heaven. All the stuff that we have at the Akedah is going to happen here. The difference is that the child is going to move off to a different future. What happens at the end of the story? Should we skip ahead? At the end of the story, let's go to, we'll skip the real drama and get to verse 20.
I'm the only student in class asked to read. The rest of these people here are lazy. I'm just going to point that out. Vayhi Elohim et hanar vayigdal vayeshev bamidbar vayhi roveh kashet. So God is with this young man, and now he's called a nar. I guess you imagine him as a small child because someone's carrying him, but now I get a sense like he's older somehow, and he's growing, and he's dwelling in the desert, and he becomes a bowman. Vayeshev b'midbar Paran v'tikach lo imo isha me'eretz Mitzrayim. And he's in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother finds an Egyptian woman for him to marry. It evokes the Mitzrit, Sarah called Hagara Mitzrit, an Egyptian woman. I guess she's true to her cultural roots, and she finds an Egyptian woman for her son.
So let me ask you a question. Reading this just at face value, is this a happy ending to the story or isn't it?
I guess it depends on whose happiness. I feel like for Hagar, maybe it's happy. She's no longer a maidservant, this woman who doesn't like her, but she's returned to her cultural roots. Yishmael is growing nicely, and it seems like he's flourishing, I guess, and God is with him, which sounds like it's good news for him. Sarah and Yitzchak, I think, are relieved and happier back on the home front. You know, as a father myself, I imagine Avraham has got to be miserable because I'm assuming he loved this child. And this child, you know, the way this finishes, this child's not coming back to him. It doesn't say he wanders around and come. You don't get the impression he's popping over for Sunday dinner and checking in. You get the strong feeling that God's with this child, and my takeaway in parentheses, but his father isn't.
Okay, so they're off to a different future, a different destiny, right? They've got their own covenantal thing going on where there's a different nation that's going to be built through them. And Avraham is separated from this child, and I agree with you totally that it seems like that separation is going to be permanent. Except after Avraham dies, he's going to come back into the picture, but throughout their lives, that's it. And I also agree with you on the happy ending. And as a mother and a mother-in-law, I can say it doesn't get better than this, where your child decides to settle right next to you and live next door and marry the woman that you choose, and it's all great. The on the personal level, if we look at this chapter on a personal level, Hagar and Yishmael, I think, come out okay. They really do. It's a happy ending for them. And I think you're right, for Sarah, it's probably good, although who knows how she lives with all of that angst that her husband is living with. And I think you're right that for Avraham, it's a very, very difficult conclusion where he actually ends up sacrificing a child. Mm-hmm. But it seems that the people who are not included in the covenant, the main covenant that this book of Bereishit is talking about, they can have that happy ending, that personal ending. And I don't know how far to push this. Is there a causal connection in there between giving up on the covenant and having a happy life? But that is something that I think is a very troubling conclusion to this, that the person in the covenant is going to have difficulty, and the person out of the covenant is going to have a decent existence.
So what do you do with that? I mean, if that's the. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like I'm already feeling anxious thinking about, and I think that is a really strong conclusion, that the ones who, I mean, we know it, especially with the Akedah coming up. Yitzchak, as the son who remains, he gets to experience the joy and the thrills of his father putting his knife to his throat, which is even worse than what Yishmael had to go through. So I'm wondering what that sense of takeaway is. What is that telling us, especially on Rosh Hashanah?
Gee, I thought you were going to answer that. Okay. I want to make the problem more difficult before we even think about answering it. This is just the precursor to the main event, which is the Akedah, where God says, okay, now we've knocked that son out of the equation. You've got one left. Now I want you to take him, and I don't want you to just throw him out into the desert. I want you, as you said so delicately, take a knife to his throat and kill him. This is really cruel and really difficult. And God says, if you want to be my, as Kierkegaard famously said, my knight of faith, this is the way to get there. Okay? Very, very complicated. So what do we do with all of it? Zvi?
Well, I'm hoping I'm going to hear something stronger. For me, really, there are two ways to go. I'm sure there are more than two, but yeah. One is, yeah, that this is what we're challenged to think about, this idea of transcending our own personal needs and desires and happiness in that small scale, and aspire to put that aside in favor of this bigger picture that we're investing in, God's picture, the Jewish people's future, and live with that. And I guess the other spin is to say that is our real happiness, that the joy that we might feel in our sort of local temporal accomplishments is small compared to the joy we can potentially feel by being part of this larger eternal story. The second one is far more aspirational than where I am right now, but I guess that would be the challenge, that ultimately, when you become the knight of faith, maybe when you're, I'm not there, when you are there, maybe family life and personal connection and all that pales in comparison to having that special relationship with God.
Wow. Okay. That sounds like a really difficult religion to belong to.
Right.
And yet this takes center stage, in the book of Bereshit and on Rosh Hashanah. And again, I want to look at these two stories as two parts of a whole, where the text seems to be going out of its way to make this point. The way that the sense that I make out of it, and I don't claim to have an answer, but I find both models, both Avraham and Sodom and Avraham at the Akedah, and I think the chapter that we just studied really provides a beautiful transition between the two, moving out in both directions, back toward chapter 18 and Avraham arguing with God, and forward toward the Akedah and Avraham being silent and submissive to God, presenting those as basically two modes that we live with. One of them is the one that's much more comfortable for us, which is that when we see injustice, when we feel that we have to sacrifice on a personal level to belong to God's covenant, and, you know, you look at events throughout the world, sometimes it's really, really hard to be part of this covenant. I think Rav Amital famously said, you know, if that's what it means, atava chartanu, you chose us, you know, I'd rather not have that particular favor. Sometimes it's really, really hard. We have two modes of responding. One is to argue and to say it's unfair. I don't accept this. We look for our philosophical constructs, whatever we can find to make sense of it. We want to demand answers of God. We want to demand answers of our literature. We want to look, and we want to be that lion in Sodom that Avraham was, and we want God to concede and say, you know what, maybe it wasn't so fair. Maybe I can back down on this one. But Rosh Hashanah, and to me personally, I find a great deal of power in this, that we kind of transition away from that, and I wouldn't want to transition away from it completely and permanently. But to me, it's very powerful to have a couple of days a year, Rosh Hashanah in particular, the 2 days where we spend a lot of time talking about God as a sovereign, as a melech, as a king. And that's something that's very hard, I think, for a modern ear to hear. We don't really relate so well to kings. But the idea that there's something that's so much greater than we are, that we can't even begin to approach it, that we completely humble ourselves in front of it. Recently, I read a wonderful book by James Kugel, who wrote a book called In the Valley of the Shadow, where he uses this wonderful word. He calls it starkness, that there's this void that we live in all the time. But because we surround ourselves by all kinds of things that make us feel bigger and better, we don't realize the void that we're living in. But sometimes there can be a traumatic event, something, an illness, God forbid, or something that makes us realize just how small we are. And I think, to me, Rosh Hashanah kind of forces that in almost, I wouldn't say an artificial way, but it creates that atmosphere of starkness and smallness for us, and says, for these 2 days, God is great, God is king, and you are not. You are all Avraham at the Akedah, where what's expected from you is not to be the philosopher, but to be the humble, silent servant, and to just take whatever it is with complete belief. I'm not saying it's easy. I'm not saying it's not incredibly complex and difficult, but I do think there's a great deal of power in it. And I think that's what I'm looking for on Rosh Hashanah, is to suspend my Sodom part and embrace my Akedah part, and hope that could be the beginning of real prayer.
Thank you very much. This was great. I learned a lot. I hope all of you listening also learned a lot. And we look forward to doing more of these in the future. Shana Tova, everybody. Happy, healthy, wonderful year to all of us.
This Pardes Life is an original podcast production from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, please visit www.elmad.pardes.org. ELMAD.pardes.org.